whether they'll come up with a combination print and website operation, or whether it'll be entirely digital, or whether it'll be crowdsourced, co-created. I don't know all those answers, but I have a great deal of confidence because I look back to, say, 1974 when John Greeley and Juno and I were sitting there covering the legislature and sitting in some smoky bar down on Front Street and saying, you know, we ought to start a paper, a weekly paper. Mm-hmm. And by gosh, we did.
Yeah, you did, and had a huge impact. And following and since you now when did you leave?
We left Alaska in October 1995.
Okay, 1995. So
the newspaper war ended in 1992.
Okay, sounds good. So at that point, you know, just jumping way ahead, of course we had and this is a story that is I mean you cover it well and the novelist Christopher Moore could bring the comedy to Alaska. It's just so absurd. We had a fellow who was sleeping with a teenage prostitute and a senator's house, presumably without the senator's knowing, and really dominating Alaska's politics. And it took an incompetent group of federal investigators to break that story. There is that sort of undercurrent in Alaskan history of this underworld, and that you handled with a great deal of courage from the very beginning, from following the mobster in your VW Beetle, which is a wonderful story. I'm sure you get. I'm sure everyone you interview or interviews you is asking you to repeat that story.
I think we have to talk about that more in terms of the intelligence than the courage, but that's kind of you to say.
Okay. Yeah, but you know what happened is you dealt with it really well, and why don't you tell the story for the people who haven't read the book yet?
Well, I was a young reporter, and I had gotten a tip from some law enforcement agencies that a couple of guys from actual and organized crime family in Arizona had come to Alaska to sort of scout out opportunities, you know, just like all the other businessmen were. They saw a pipeline boom coming and thought there'd be some money, and so they had come up to look into that, and so I got pretty interested in that, and I thought I should try and learn about them, and I did all the normal things that a reporter would do, and I checked the court records, you know, and I looked at the property filings and asked my sources what they knew about them, but I decided I would follow them one day. I guess I'd watched one too many Hawaii Five-O's or something on television, MacGyver, and so I hopped in my car, which was this was 1973, I think. And my car was a bright yellow Volkswagen Bug, which was kind of an unusual car in Anchorage in those days. And I started following these guys in their big black town car, whatever it was. And they went to a shooting range down on the Seward Highway. It's still there, actually. I saw it a couple years ago. And I hid up in the hill and watched them shooting and thought, okay, this is going to be great. I can write about this when I write about them. And so on the way home, they pulled into a supermarket, and I decided to pull in, and I parked way on the other side of the parking lot, and as I'm sitting there, I noticed that they are driving toward me, and I thought, that can't be true, and then pretty quickly it was obvious, you know, they're coming straight at me. They know that I'm following them. So I'm sitting there, and the car pulls in front of me, blocks my car in, and the electric window on this thing goes down. And there's a guy in sunglasses smoking a cigarette, and he just stares at me. And I am terrified, truly not partly terrified, not fake terrified. I'm just scared to death. And he took a cigarette out, and he flipped it between his finger and thumb and bounced it off my car window, and they drove away. And I'm just thinking, oh, my God. And I've just seen these guys firing their pistols, you know. I mean, I'm now convinced they're mobsters. I'm convinced that they know who I am. So I ran home, make a long story slightly shorter. First thing I did was shave off my beard. I don't know why. I thought maybe they won't recognize me. And then in a few minutes, my phone rang, and somehow they had gotten my phone number in that length of time, obviously from my license plate, since that's all they knew about me. And the guy said, "Why are you following us?" in somewhat more profane language. And I said, "Well, I don't want to talk about it on the phone." And he said, "Okay, that's okay. Well, come down to my club." He owned a nightclub in Eastchester. And so I didn't know what to do. And as I was driving down there, I thought, you know what I could do? I could tell him the truth. And so that was the only plan I could think of. So when I got there, I did. And he said, "Why are you following us? What are you trying to do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a newspaper guy, and I heard you were mobsters, and I thought it'd be really good for my career if I could get a big story about you." And he sat silently for a few seconds and then just burst out laughing and said, "Oh, my God, I think you're telling me the truth." And he was so taken with that somehow. And I don't know, maybe I've romanticized this over the years, but what I thought was he thought, well, you know, at least this was a mano a mano thing, right? You came down here, you faced me, you didn't lie to me. So he decided I was probably an okay guy. And he told me, "You know, just don't do that no more. Don't follow me. If you want to know something, come ask me, man to man, and I'll tell you. Any legitimate question, you just ask me. In fact, you can ask me a question right now." And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what do I do now? If I ask the wrong question, I'm going to make him mad again. You know, I'm just about to get out of this with my skin. And so I said, "Well, I am curious how you got my phone number so quick." And he started laughing again. He says, "That's not a legitimate question. Do you understand?" And I said, "Okay, sir, I think I'm beginning to understand." And so I didn't write about it at the time because, you know, it sort of never came together. There wasn't any real story. There was a background, but no real story.
Right.
And then years later, it came out in a big national investigation involving an investigative reporter who was killed with a car bomb in Arizona. And in that story, the story of these two guys coming up to Alaska emerged. It was in one of the stories, and I found it there, and oh my God, that was true. They were really part of this organized crime family, the Bananos family from Arizona. So, you know, weird things can happen in a little old Alaska.
Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely. And where did that come from? When did you know you wanted to be a journalist? Were you at 12 years old? Did you say, you know, I want to grow up to be an investigative journalist? What happened?
I didn't really. I always liked to write. And in high school, I played sports in high school. And I also was the sports editor of my high school paper, East Anchorage High.
Uh-huh.
T-Birds forever. And so I was involved in journalism, but I wanted to be a diplomat. So what I really wanted to do was, you know, go to work for the State Department and travel the world and negotiate treaties or something. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And so I went away to college on the East Coast, and I was coming back and forth. And actually, I had met a guy while I was still in high school who was the sports editor at the Daily News, which was then a tiny paper. And he needed somebody to write high school sports stories, and I was the only high school kid he'd ever met, so he hired me to write a few stories. And I loved it. It was fun, and most important of all, they put my name in the paper, which I really liked.
Yeah.
But then I went to college to pursue this other dream, and at some point I really needed to take an easy course. You know, I had a hard semester coming up, and I talked to somebody, he said, "Well, you know, if you work for the student paper, you're pretty much guaranteed to get an A." So I thought, that's great, I'll do that. So I went down there and told them I'd worked at a paper before, and they were impressed, and they put my name in the paper again. By that point, I was hooked.
Oh,
and I abandoned all the other plans. I changed, you know, my school plans, and when I got out of college, I came straight back to Alaska and went to work at the Daily News like 2 weeks after graduation, and the rest is history.
Wow. Well, that's amazing, and so just that sports writing connection was a big impact for you. What was it like? Just as we wrap up here, what was it like after the fact writing the book? This is your first full-length book, right? Is it?
Yes, it is.
Different writing a longer book, and was it different thinking back instead of doing the immediate stories that you began your pre with?
Well, it was quite different, of course, and it's a challenge to keep the material organized and to come up with a coherent structure for it, which I hope I've done. I've gotten good feedback on the book, and I hope people find that. But it's that part is quite difficult. You can't just sit down and say, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. You have to set the scene. You have to provide background. You have to give people some sense of context. And so, you know, as you well know, it's a craft as well as an art. Yeah. Writing requires, my dad was a carpenter, and he knew how to build a beautiful cabinet, and that's a craft. And so... Yeah. I tried to learn the craft over these years, and that served me well. This is a very unusual time for American journalism. You know, the Internet has introduced so many changes. For newspapers, what it's really done is take away a lot of their advertising revenue, and so that means they don't have near as much money as they used to, and they have smaller staffs and smaller papers, and they had to scale back some of their ambitions. Now, I believe that there's a way out in the future where they can build on that foundation and get back to the kind of something like the kind of position we occupied when I was an editor, but we don't know that. And so writing this book also involved a very strange sense of, you know, I was writing history, and sometimes it almost felt like archaeology. You know, it's so different than it is today. And I hoped that the book would still be relevant today, and so I tried hard to write it not just as a history, but maybe as something that a young journalist today reading it would get a sense of why it's important to do it well. Whether you do it in a newspaper or a website or an email newsletter or a radio show, it's all the same purpose, you know, which is to try and provide a foundation of truthful information that people can then use to make their decisions. And my view is that that's fundamental for a democracy, and that one way or another, somebody's got to do that. So, you know, I hope the book will both be entertain people and for those of us who remember the history, accurately reflect it, and maybe even put journalism in a little bit of context for people. That would consider it a huge success if it can pull that off.
And, of course, the book is Write Hard, Die Free, and we're talking to Howard Weaver. I did have you brought up one other question that I wanted to ask.
Please.
And because you mentioned that your father was a carpenter, and so many of the legendary journalists, and I count you as one, come from a working-class background. And I wonder if it's because of that sense of craft that's so essential to journalism that was passed into your genes there.
Well, I think that journalism, newspaper journalism in particular, underwent a huge change in the course of my lifetime. It was entirely craftsmanlike in say 1950, and journalists very often had not graduated from college. Almost no journalist, had majored in journalism because it wasn't even taught in colleges as a major. Mm-hmm. And so it was very much a kind of apprentice program. You know, you went to work as a youngster, you got abused and sent out on the bad assignments, and had to fetch coffee for the boss and all of that stuff, but you learned your craft, and over time, if you were good at it, you moved up. In the course of my lifetime, that really changed, and some people have suggested that one of the reasons newspapers kind of lost their connection to the communities they served was that journalists started to become more and more, quote, professionals, college-educated, earning more money than the average person. It used to be a journalist earned a kind of, you know, average wage. Well, for a while there, not today, but for a while there, say 20 years ago, journalists kind of became celebrities in their own right. You know, after Watergate and television came and journalists started appearing on television and they're all wearing suits and talking about, erudite foreign affairs stories and so on. And the era of the Jimmy Breslin or the Mike Royko, you know, sitting in the neighborhood tavern talking to the bricklayer and the carpenter and the secretary and being a part of that community did begin to fade. And so I think that, once again, that's one of the opportunities for this kind of new journalism that we're looking at today, because once again, the world has changed, and so journalists are going to be relearning what their position in society is, and that offers some opportunities as well.
Okay, to be back more tied to the community. So any final words that you want to leave with us?
Well, I mean, just if you're not going to do it, Mike, I will plug the fact that I'm going to come up this afternoon and be at the bookstore and have a chance to say hi to folks if they're interested. And I'd love to continue this conversation or any other conversation. I'll be there. I'm available to read from the book or to just talk about the book. And I hope to get to meet some folks. I'm really looking forward to being
involved. Thank you so much. So we'll see you at 4 o'clock this afternoon in downtown Palmer at the bookstore there.
I'll be there.
Howard, thank you so much. It's such an honor to have you on the show, and we will be talking with you this afternoon at 4 o'clock.
All right. Marshall, nice to hear from you, and I'm looking forward to seeing everybody.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye.